On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for September 19th, 2014, the spanking edition. I'm David Plotz, the editor-at-large of Slate in Washington, D.C. On this week's show, are liberals longing, pleading for more progressive candidates, especially for president? Then, is President Obama's response to the Ebola crisis in West Africa enough? Is it the right response? And then the Adrian Peterson case ignites a debate about corporal punishment. Is hitting your kid ever okay? Or I should say, when is hitting your kid okay? Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. And in Slate Plus, Emily and I are going to battle about whether Slate is too liberal. Slate Plus getting extra segments of the GabFest. And you can sign up for that by going to slate.com/GabFestPlus or by emailing me directly at david.plotz@slate.com, where you can get the best offer. Joining me in New York is Emily Bazelon, no longer Slate senior editor, now staff writer at the New York Times Magazine. Hello, Emily.
Hello. Although I haven't started at the Times yet, but that's okay.
So you're unemployed.
I'm unemployed. I am a host.
If you need trash picked up, Emily could come do that. If you need
leaves raked,
babysitting for your kids.
Grass mowed. Yeah.
Legal advice given by a member of the New York bar, the Connecticut bar?
No, not. I've retired from the Connecticut and Massachusetts bars because I didn't want to pay the fees.
Cut rate legal advice given?
Exactly. I think it's actually against the law to give legal advice without a license. You're only getting me in trouble.
John Dickerson, you can tell from the giggling over there, is in Colorado. He's stoned. No, John, you're in Colorado. Why are you in Colorado?
I'm in Colorado because there's a great Senate race here and then also a race for the governor's office. So lots of politics to cover in Colorado.
Do people in Colorado make jokes about pot all the time the way people now make all these jokes about Colorado because we're juvenile?
No. The only way it's come up in the context of my reporting over the last few days is as people try and explain and classify the state and it's where it sits in its evolution from being a really conservative state to one that's voted twice for Obama and voted for Democrats, is that they say that the Republicans here, you have some social conservative Republicans who are a familiar breed, but then you have this other kind of voter who is sort of Republican in their dislike of regulation and taxes and the role of government, but they're also, that they also like to get high. That phrasing has been used by like three different people. So it's used in that context, which I guess is supposed to be a stand-in for sort of social liberalism, distinct from the social conservatives who are also in Colorado.
Right. Before we get to the meat of the show, I just want to tease a whole bunch of live shows that are coming up in the next couple of months. So on October 5th, there's a sold-out Superfest in San Francisco that's sold out, so too bad. But there is, on October 8th in Los Angeles, Acura is sponsoring this whole series of shows that we and the Culture Fest are doing. So Acura is sponsoring a show in Los Angeles, slate.com/LA Culture Fest on October 8th. That's going to be amazing. They've got a great special guest there. Another Culture Fest sponsored by Acura at the Wilbur Theater in Boston on October 20th. And we are going to have two more shows. There's going to be another Superfest in New York on November 17th. And our annual Conundrum show is going to be in Chicago on November 12th. And we'll have ticketing for that available probably in the next week. But just mark your calendar, Chicago, November 12th, and New York for Superfest with us and the Culture Gabfest and Mike Pesca on November 17th. Barring illness, inconceivable gaffe, or a Faustian bargain between Martin O'Malley and the devil, Hillary Clinton will be the Democratic nominee for president. Once more, the Democrats will turn to a moderate, hawkish, slow-moving Democratic leader. Nothing like the young, flame-throwing conservatives of the GOP. We have seen in recent weeks the interesting New York gubernatorial race where progressive Zephyr Teachout and Tim Wu made a great big challenge to Andrew Cuomo and his lieutenant governor. There seems to be an appetite, or perhaps there's an appetite for more progressive candidates, and perhaps even a more progressive candidate for president. So we want to ask if there's any possibility there's going to be one, and if so, where that person will come from. John, as you look out across this landscape, as people get ready both for the 2014 election and then anticipating 2016, do you see a yearning for much more progressive candidates from Democrats?
Yeah, I see a yearning for sort of three different things. Yearning, one, for an old-time religion progressive candidate who speaks proudly about the role of government and how government can do things to counterbalance the power of corporations and special interests. And then the other thing I see is people who want that but really like Hillary Clinton, don't see a disconnect between the two. And then I find the third, which is they pretty much like Hillary Clinton, but they want a race and a debate and a discussion. So those are sort of the three views.
Emily, do you think there's a reasonable candidate out there who can create that discussion or who wants to create that discussion? Certainly not Martin O'Malley, the dreary governor of Maryland, but is Elizabeth Warren, could she do that? Is there anyone else who could do that that you think might do it?
I think Elizabeth Warren is the plausible person who could do it. I also wonder if it's really going to be a good thing for Warren if she takes on Clinton, or if she would be better off sort of dancing up to the edge of that enough to get her base excited and then backing off because she wants, you know, what's best for the party in some general way and holding off to see if Clinton loses or, you know, coming back later. Although she's kind of old, right? I'm not sure she could run in 8 years.
What are the progressive issues that people want to talk about? There's general inequality, which Warren has been good about. There's the strength of Wall Street. There's the minimum wage. There's sort of foreign adventurism. Like people want to spend less on the military and do less with the military. What are the other ones? Or are those the main ones?
Well, actually, let me just jump in on something like the minimum wage. One of the reasons that this is fuzzy and that if Hillary Clinton or when she runs, it makes it difficult for a quote-unquote progressive candidate is because support for increasing the minimum wage is something Hillary Clinton talks about and supports. It's a 70% public issue. If the idea is to put a progressive candidate forward who is a real stark contrast to Hillary Clinton, there are issues. If minimum wage is in the issue set, then the distinctions will be blurred and that quote-unquote progressive candidate won't go anywhere. The getting to the what is the crucial issue, that's hard too, because it's basically what I hear about is the idea is basically that the game is rigged and that lobbyists and Wall Street have too much power. They're not regulated, and whenever government tries to regulate them or do anything to change the policies that affect them, either at the business level or even the taxes that, say, hedge fund managers pay, that nobody can break through the power that those institutions have over politics. And you need a candidate who's going to go out there and pledge to break them up, fight the rigged system, and that's the kind of thing that Elizabeth Warren talks about. But it sort of has to stay focused on that, because as a political matter, that would be presumably the area where Hillary Clinton would be the most vulnerable.
That seems exactly right to me. And I also think it's no small thing that the Clintons are not well positioned to prove that they won't cozy up to Wall Street and banking lobbyists when they get into office, because that's a lot of who they, you know, it's who they raise money for their foundation. It's who was in Bill Clinton's administration to some degree. There's some tension there in Hillary Clinton claiming that, you know, oh, yeah, I'm going to take on the big bad banks. I just don't think she has huge credibility on that one.
Why do you think it is that the Republicans, conservatives, have been so successful in churning up these generally young, generally like quite far to the right candidates, not just at the presidential level, but really more at the level of Congress and governor's offices and even state houses, who've managed to inject all sorts of what seem at the time quite radical ideas into politics, which then, because of the force of these activists, kind of get pulled into the mainstream of the Republican Party? That has happened on the right. Why has the left been so poor at the same thing, or not even tried to do the same thing? You know, there is support for the minimum wage, and that's growing, but it isn't a galvanizing issue. There aren't galvanizing issues successfully on the left the way there have been on the right.
Well, like, give me an example, because you have two different kinds of galvanizing issues on the right. You have the social issues, which have galvanized a certain group of Republicans, but which are on the wane. If you look at something like same-sex marriage, or if you look at who's using cultural issues to make distinctions in these races this year, it's mostly Democrats who are being either successful or who are getting a lot of traction from doing that. And then, of course, then there are the fiscal regulation and tax issues. You know, the reason those have worked over the years is because you have a lot of voters in the middle who like their taxes to be low, too. The issues that work are the ones that, you know, have a larger audience to them.
Well, I'd say climate change was an issue where the Republicans are completely wrong and in the thrall of like a very, very far to the right, very anti-truth kind of ideology, but which owns the party. And there's this interesting piece that Ezra Klein wrote about on Vox, where he talks about some social scientists who have been studying the differences between conservatives and liberals and say that we've sorted ourselves and that liberals tend to be people who want compromise and conservatives tend to be people who want people who stand on principle, and that you've built two parties that not only have different beliefs about what they want to happen in the world, but different ways that they want their politicians to go about doing it. And that what that has done is sort of injected a quite ideological and idealistic tenor into Republican politics, which doesn't exist in the Democratic politics, where people are just highly pragmatic and compromise oriented.
Yeah, I was really struck by this. The scientists, there are political scientists, Matthew Grossman and David Hopkins, and they were arguing, or at least as Ezra Klein put it, that Republicans are deeply invested in philosophy and Democrats in policy. And it's intuitive once you start thinking about it, because Democrats think the government is a tool for change. And so there's legislation you can pass where you get things done. Whereas if you're in favor of smaller government and skeptical about government, then you want to pull back on it all the time. And your brand of philosophical or ideological purity has to do with preventing things from happening, which is something then you would worry about compromise, because you would think like, oh, every time I give in, the government grows a little more. There's this constant creep going on, et cetera. It was an enlightening way to think about the distinctions.
Did that persuade you, John? I'm interested. Persuaded me, too.
Well, it didn't persuade me because it's obvious. I mean, which is to say,
persuaded you and seemed so obvious it wasn't even worth saying.
The reason I was mumbling is because it doesn't, I mean, it's what's great about this study is that it analyzes something that's true and uses numbers, and, you know, there are things you know, and then there are things that you can prove by actually looking at the data and doing interviews. And so in that way, it wonderfully crystallized what has been my experience in covering politics for a long time. Where this shows up in its most interesting form for me over the years is the tension within the Republican Party between conservatives who, you know, Republican does not equal conservative. And obviously the conservative movement is larger and has more power in the Republican Party than the liberal movement does in the Democratic Party. So it's just a matter of numbers, which is why the ideologues in the Republican Party are more powerful than the ideologues in the Democratic Party. But the rise of the people who believe in freedom of markets and freedom of personal behavior, you know, obviously they don't want the government doing much of anything except its most basic responsibilities. And the tension between that and the sort of George W. Bush Republicans who thought government could engage in behavior to fix education and fix Medicare and do other things that, and Newt Gingrich was that way too, even though they're sometimes called conservatives. They're not conservatives by the definition of true conservatives and by the definition of this study. So that's been the tension in the Republican Party and tension in politics between the ideological wing and the kind of let's use government towards conservative ends wing that's been battling since, you know, Eisenhower Taft.
You know what's weird? This is to make the same point I made a minute ago, but now I'm going to make it kind of quizzically. It is weird to me that the Democratic Party, which is a party of the young and has had two presidents who were really successful at appealing to the young over the past 20 years, has so few young voices that anyone wants to hear from who have anything interesting to say. It's very odd. And in contrast to the Republican Party, we've talked about this before, that it may be just that politicians who are coming of age now or in their 40s grew up in the Reagan era and were likely to be galvanized by that. And then in 10 years, we'll see these progressive politicians coming of age. But it's strange that the tribune of the progressive movement is a woman in her late 60s, Elizabeth Warren, or mid 60s.
I think also what we're seeing here is the degree of care and attention Republicans have given to state offices and all of the developing of the bench, where if you put a lot of energy into school board races and state senators and representatives, then you kind of start building those kinds of young people into the candidates of the future. And it just seems like there's some of that happening with Democrats more than there used to be, but we're still suffering from historical lack of attention.
And a lot of younger voters who tend to skew towards the Democratic Party think their energies and efforts are better spent actually accomplishing things as opposed to getting engaged in government, which doesn't accomplish anything. So that may be part of it, too. One thing that was striking about Hillary Clinton's visit to Iowa this past weekend was hearing Tom Harkin give what was probably the most eloquent speech of the day, talking about his father and how he didn't have work during the Depression and how crushing that was to his father and watching that take its toll on him. And then when the WPA was brought into existence by Franklin Roosevelt, it gave his father a job. His father went and worked on creating a lake that was not far from where the event was being held. And so Harkin has his father's WPA card in his office to remind him, as he said, that there is a role for government to help people and give them hope. Now, George Bush used to say, government can't give people hope. And Harkin's point, which people don't really make often, is even Democrats, I mean, is that there's a role for government to improve and lift people's lives. And when he told the story of his father, it made that very clear. Even Elizabeth Warren, when she talks about it, the system's rigged, that may be true, but the Harkin riff felt like, to me, much more powerful, but also obviously much more dangerous for politicians who are worried about being called socialists, which is a very powerful attack.
God, that's so pathetic that I'm not bashing you, John, but the idea that you'd be so cringing about the word socialist that you wouldn't be willing to really make the case for the government and the way it can, in fact, offer people hope and make things better as opposed to worse. That just makes me so mad. And if Democrats fall into that, they're not going to. This is like the way in which Alison Grimes is afraid to say anything good about the Affordable Care Act, even though it's working really well in Kentucky, because she thinks that it's unpopular. And yet she's going to lose by, you know, probably by being so hesitant and reticent and wimpy about it.
All right. Last question on this. Two-part, very monosyllabic question. Will someone run against Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primary? Will that person be a progressive to the left of her? Emily?
No. I have no idea. John? Let's have an educated opinion.
Yes, but nominally. I mean, not in a way that...
It won't be Elizabeth Warren?
I don't think so. And even if she runs, it would be a nominal candidacy. Because,
in which case, she shouldn't do it.
Well, I don't know. If you believe in the ideas, then go get in the fight and just use the fight as a way to promote the ideas. I mean, I think that that's a perfectly noble and great thing to do, whatever party you're in. But it doesn't mean that she'll survive for a number of reasons, not the least of which is you need money to run campaigns, and Wall Street's very helpful in getting you money.
David, what's your prediction?
Yes, someone will run, but it will be to the right. Okay, let's move on to our next topic. The Ebola crisis is getting scarier and scarier on the moderately scary front. The epidemic is raging worse than ever in West Africa, with more than 5,000 cases, more than 2,000 deaths, no sign of abatement. In fact, it's accelerating. The economies of the region where the epidemic is worst are being devastated. Trade is grinding to a halt. The basic order of the economy is collapsing. People, just the networks that people hold people together have collapsed. More scary for us, I suppose, is the speculation bruited about that the longer this Ebola epidemic rages, the more likely the virus is to mutate and perhaps become a more virulent airborne form, which could be catastrophic. There are virologists who say, actually, let's not worry about that. Let's just deal with the epidemic at hand. So, Emily, the president responded this week. He's sending troops, 3,000 troops to West Africa, setting up medical centers, providing infrastructure and discipline. Does that seem like it's enough? Is it the right response?
I don't know if it's enough. I definitely wanted him and NATO and Europe to be doing at least this much and more. And I kind of hate to say that. When we talked about Ebola, I don't remember if it was a month ago or more, it seemed like we could be concerned about the tragedy of the people dying and getting sick and not be too scared. And now it seems like, wow, this really took off almost exponentially. And public health experts who seemed fairly sanguine are now truly alarmed. These stories, I'm sort of allergic to them because I don't like it when things go really wrong and I have to be scared about possibilities that are unlikely but really bad if they happen. And now we basically are in that mode of possible serious calamity.
is this keeping you guys up at night the way nuclear terror kept you up as a kid or climate change keeps me up? Do you think like, shoot, there's going to be a pandemic that's going to affect my family at some point? Maybe not this one, but that there will be one.
Yeah, I think there will be one probably, and that we should take this one seriously, even though it still seems like the likelihood is that it won't be this particular one. But it does seem that this whole question of whether we really have the public health capability and infrastructure to do a good job of predicting, to contain, all of these things, we seem like we're sort of being caught flat-footed.
John, as a measure of the employment of the U.S. government, did this feel like we are doing the right thing to ask the same question I asked Emily a second ago, or should there be a lot more happening?
You know, if this is growing at the exponential rate that they say it now is, and you read these accounts of how hard it is to treat in these places where there just is no structure and where it feels like it's just a drop in the bucket. I mean, I kept thinking about, and I don't want to take the analogy too far here, but, you know, when you think about our conversations last week about the threat of the global jihadist movement and the arguments made for that, if they contain it, then it was perfect. But it's puny if, by the measurement against, like, how wildly your imagination can embrace a complete massive outbreak.
David, you're the most scientifically minded of the three of us, I think. Do you feel like you have a good way to gauge whether we're at the proper level of alarm, whether the scientists we should trust are talking about this in the right way, or do you just feel a little at sea?
Well, I think it's very hard to understand this. I've heard perfectly reasonable people who I otherwise think of as being rational people, spouting the most arrant, idiotic conspiracy theories about this disease and about our response to it that make me worried. If this were happening in a different part of the world, the public health infrastructure would have been mobilized much more effectively, and this epidemic would have been brought under control really quickly. And one thing that makes it kind of easy for us to relax about it is that it doesn't seem to be spreading beyond the borders of the countries where the epidemic is not, it hasn't gotten out into Nigeria, it hasn't really gotten out into Senegal. It's confined itself to the three countries where it's really been. And so there's a sense like, well, it's terrible. There are thousands of people who are dying, but we're not really at risk. And there's no immediate prospect that we're going to become at risk. So whereas when there was the SARS epidemic and which was the one in China, I'm now forgetting.
Wasn't that
H1N1.
Yeah. When H1N1, there was a mobilization around that was really effective and really squeezed these things down pretty quickly after an initial non-response. So the response definitely isn't what it would be if Western interests felt themselves to be threatened. And that, of course, should make you feel bad as a human being that we are unwilling and unable to mobilize to deal with something that happens in a poor and not economically important part of the world because like it just isn't affecting our interests. Actually, I want to connect. But almost the most important thing to think about in this story, it really does connect to ISIS, which is that the main danger of this Ebola epidemic, I suspect, in the long run, is not actually the people it kills now and the epidemic it rages now. I don't think it's going to the virus, based on like what little I understand. It doesn't seem like it's going to spread beyond this region, but it's going to take apart these societies and destabilize these societies and take away the kind of normal infrastructure and ways that people communicate. And that leaves these governments and countries vulnerable to the kind of destabilizing forces that you see in poor and unsteady countries around the world. So what you see, you know, thank God this isn't happening in Nigeria, where you have Boko Haram as a viable sort of alternative force within the country, because into the vacuums of power that are developing will come awful, pernicious, evil forces. And that has me almost more worried than the epidemic does.
Right. Especially because this is going to take such an economic toll on Liberia, Sierra Leone and Guinea.
You know, one thing I wonder, which I wish I had the answer to, and perhaps some listener for whom this is their area of expertise will write in and let us know. But remember during H1N1, the president, in a primetime press conference, was basically giving the country, this was back in 2009, was giving the country lessons on, like, good hygiene. You know, he said, like, keep your hands washed, cover your mouth when you cough, stay home if you're sick. What I wonder is the extent to which, you know, we have really fast working networks in this country, not only through social media, but also if the president wants to turn his attention to something, he can get a lot of people watching it on the news. or watching it in prime time. And I wonder how quickly and effectively that changes behavior, so that if there were, with the H1N1, did it run its course and that was it, or did the president saying that actually have any beneficial effect? And can we take any comfort in or lessons from the ability for us to sort of snap into shape if something like this happened and was spreading in the United States?
I would say two things about that. One, I suspect we have a significant ability to snap into shape in the event of a real crisis in this country or in most of the developed world. The other point I would say is public health measures and public health infrastructure and planning for epidemics is one of the very best investments the world can make. It's a no-brainer, and it's so frustrating to see that the World Health Organization is underfunded and incapable, to see how little preparation has been done when you think about the benefits of that preparation and how many lives are saved, how much economic growth is saved, how much sort of peace of mind is saved when you can have a robust, intelligent, well-thought-out public health response. And I hope these crises never actually have the effect you want, but you would hope that it has the effect of saying, you know what, a big public health investment would be a really wise thing for the world to think about.
You know what I'd like, David, is for you to do a fresco comparing the money spent and worry and energy spent on the contagion of Islamic radicalism and the number of deaths that could create relative to contagion like this, and the efforts on both sides taken to stop both.
Yeah.
And just the disparity in the two.
Yep. All right, let's go on to our next topic. Star Minnesota Vikings running back Adrian Peterson was suspended from his team this week, then unsuspended, then resuspended, over charges that he severely abused one of his children by whipping him with a switch, with a branch, maybe with a belt, actually. Maybe with a branch.
With a branch.
It was a branch.
Yeah, but he also has belts. The Peterson controversy is a metastasis of the Ray Rice story, which has transfixed football fans and disgraced the league over the past several weeks. Literally, it seems every day another player is implicated in some form of domestic violence. What Peterson did is a form of domestic violence. It's a form of domestic violence which is generally sanctioned or generally considered legal. We'll talk about that. Emily, it's considered more legal than punching your wife in the face.
Let's
put it that way.
Yes, that's true.
But it has ignited this fascinating, very fierce debate about corporal punishment and whether it is ever okay to hit your kids. So first, just let's have a full disclosure. Were you, John and Emily and David, were you ever spanked or whipped by your parents?
Hold on. Before you answer, shouldn't you guys guess the answer to that about each of the others?
I think that John probably got a few spankings and that you probably didn't, David.
I think that John got a few spankings. I suspect you got a couple of spankings, Emily.
More like swats.
I was about to say that. I can see your dad in the front seat and you're like just making trouble and him reaching back and just like cuffing you with his long arm.
You got it.
Yeah. What do you guess, John?
Yeah. Well, I would have guessed basically what you did and that you weren't spanked. Yeah. No, I was often and there was like a ceremonial aspect to it. I mean, there was a lot of, it wasn't just a swat, you know, there was a period of waiting. And then I remember once getting spanked for not brushing my teeth.
Huh? Yeah.
So
that's so funny
you...
because you were in that toothpaste ad.
That's right.
That's why it's all the funnier.
That's true.
Do you think
I was spanked, by the way, a couple of times, not often.
But deliberately, not like
deliberately.
Just in a moment of emotion. So do you guys think those punishments affected you deeply, taught you something, made you fear your parents? Will Salatin wrote a powerful piece for Slate this week in which he recalled being paddled in school, and he said he has no idea why he was being punished, really anything except that he just remembers being hit. And he was arguing that that's all kids remember, and it's why so much research shows that physical punishment is completely ineffective as a form of discipline or teaching anyone a lesson.
Well, I certainly remember being spanked, and I remember no other form of punishment my parents ever gave me, and there must have been other punishments. I also remember being hit once by a coach in high school for no particularly good reason. So I feel like my parents were so upset at having to spank me. My mother was very upset. I understood the gravity of it. And
did it because she felt like she had to? It was
It definitely hurt her more than it hurt me. Do I remember what it was for? No. But did it make an impact? Sure, it did. Yeah.
Do you think were you standing up for spanking here, or do you think it was just a bad idea?
I'm going to stand up for spanking. I would also, can we also just, in the spirit of full disclose, have you ever hit your kids? I've definitely hit my kids.
I have, but never deliberately,
I'm going
to
spank
you. I've never been thought through about it at all. But when my younger son was just refusing to sleep as a toddler, I would like pat him on the back. So, and then it would just get to be too hard because I was really angry with him. And then I actually left the room because I felt like I was out of control. So to me, all of this seems like it teeters on the brink of scary. And I can't imagine making it a part of my child rearing strategy.
So I don't think I've ever swatted the kids. I have definitely grabbed a child's arm who was, you know, about to run into the street or...
That's different.
...wasn't moving. But I mean, grabbed it, you know, with a little bit extra. But that's the worst, because what conveyed to me in the times I was either hit or spanked was, like, total loss of control from the person who should have it. And there are studies that show that the best way to teach kids self-control is to model it for them yourself. And you could argue that a spanking, you know, you'll be spanked at 5 o'clock tonight, at least the terms are clear and it seems thought through. It may be stupidly thought through, but in terms of the child, they understand like a punishment is being meted out for a specific thing, and it doesn't seem impulsive. And I think the impulsive violence or impulsive swatting, that's harder, it seems to me, a lot harder to defend than spanking.
I agree, even as a practitioner of the impulsive.
And yet, I agree with that completely, but I'm still really skeptical about the deliberate, I'm going to spank you at 5 p.m. I just don't really, in the end, see why that would be the way you would choose to punish your kid.
Is
that going to work,
But think of all the different ways that one punishes children or punishes your spouse or punishes your colleagues, whoever it is you're punishing, because we engage in forms of punishment all the time. You get engaged in like a silent treatment or like a, you know, cutting remarks or shouting at that. I mean, I see why what Adrian Peterson did is put off in a category which is criminal behavior and for which parents should be punished. I don't see why a form of mild hitting that is deliberative, that is thought through, which doesn't cause any actual physical harm, is so categorically different than the forms of emotional violence that we practice all the living day on other people.
I mean, I'm all for the idea that emotional manipulation can be damaging and hurtful, and you have to be really careful as a parent that you're being clear with kids about where lines are without going over that edge. But I don't get why that's a defensive spanking. That's like, okay, it could be worse. You could do something incredibly emotionally cruel, so what's so bad? Like, why are those the choices?
Because we're human beings and we're weak.
I mean, I think you can make a case for the kind of limited corporal punishment that David just described. We don't do it because I think there are more effective ways to get across the message. And it's clear with kids that messages of this kind of strength need to be sent on certain things. I mean, their brains just haven't developed enough to understand the subtlety of a long 20-minute conversation on some topics. On most topics, yes. But I just don't think, I think corporal punishment is just like pain and cruelty that they may get it for 5 minutes, but doesn't have a lasting teaching that you would want when you're talking about, you know, some issues that are serious. I mean, getting spanked for not brushing your teeth is not serious.
But John, it's I totally disagree that it's not lasting. It certainly could be lasting.
But all we remember, David, is that your mom spanked you. You don't remember why or what she was trying to impart with that. You just remember that she was sorry to be doing it and that it hurt.
But your lesson from that is, oh, it clearly doesn't work. It's only imparted
this
pain.
I have lots of research to back me up.
My
you
lesson from that is well, you have no research to back you up. You're just like, you have other people's research.
Right. Lots of studies showing that this is not a good way to deter, to teach kids.
I doubt there are studies which disaggregate the deliberative, planned, highly infrequent spanking of Judith Plotz that separates that from the frequent, irrational, impulsive violence brought upon children by
most parents.
Oh,
I think you're wrong about that. But I also feel like you're defending your own experience because you basically had a loving and caring childhood. And there's a way in which we so quickly fall into the patterns of our own youth. And that's exactly what Adrian Peterson did. He was hit as a kid. He was surprised when the police questioned him that anyone was imagining this was child abuse, even though it's clear from the text he sent this kid's mom that he knew he had gone across some line. He was basically, he didn't quite apologize, but he was saying like, oh, you're going to be mad at me because he has this cut that was more serious than I needed to inflict on his leg. And like, oh, that was pretty bad, but I didn't go overboard. I mean, you can really see how he's trying. I think he sees himself as a loving parent doing what was done to him.
Right.
He sees himself as that in retrospect, but there's nothing you can, it seems to me an impossible case to make that what he actually did in the heat of the moment, not just the severity of the blows, but also the stuffing of the leaves in the mouth and all of that, conveyed anything other than a total loss of control.
And it sounded like his kid was scared, too.
Yeah, and in punishment for his kid losing control, basically, over a video game. I mean, in retrospect, you can say, I had these, loving intentions, but if that's what he does when he's offering controlled corporal punishment, I'd hate to see what happens when he loses control.
Does the fact that the significant majority of Americans support spanking mean anything?
What do you mean? Of course it means something. It means that lots of people are spanking their kids and that they don't want it to be illegal.
But do you feel like these people are just so misguided and all American parents are really wrongheaded and these ideas that they have are just
ignorant? It's a spectrum. I mean, as you were just laying out, there are ways in which people get spanked that they either shrug off or even decide that they embrace because they feel like they basically were well-raised and that was part of it. And it either wasn't so bad or who knows, maybe it helped make them who they were. But I really feel it's just that we fall into these patterns. We reflect back what happened to us.
Go ahead, yes.
Bend the conversation before we get out of it to football just in general. You know, so Time magazine has a somewhat sensationalist cover this week with a young boy, a 16-year-old, who died from brain injury while playing football. We all know about the concussion controversy and revelations over the years with the NFL, but there's lots of studies, too, about the damage it does to little kids when they're playing because their bodies aren't developed, their necks and heads are not developed. And now you have all these domestic violence charges, and the football itself has coarsened over, the last 15 years. Do you guys feel like this sport is on its way out in some, it may take 40 more years, but that there's something on all these fronts, the savagery that's a part of football that's gotten worse, just makes it untenable as the national pastime that it is?
To me, the collision course is between the passionate love of football that so many people in this country have, including people who live in my house, and the financial risk, the exposure of the concussion suits, of anything that can get tied to the game as a really bad physical consequence. And that, I think it's just a cold, hard calculation. Like, does the liability of Pee Wee Football League and high school football become so great and there's no helmet good enough and the brain injuries are so prevalent that, the game just can't afford to insure itself anymore? That's the only question.
We're not remotely close to anything like that. They've just bought off the NFL players.
Exactly.
At professional level, this issue doesn't matter anymore. The game has never been more popular at a youth level than it is now.
Which I think is crazy, but it's true. I mean, when I saw that headline the other...
It's highly regionally biased. So, I'm sure in our relative cohorts, there's almost nobody who's playing football.
It's not true. There's football at my kid's school, but it's a big thing.
The sad thing, too, is that football is a great... I mean, my experience with it was fantastic. The best sports experience I had.
And what about it? Because you had a really good
except for the three concussions, which I'm sure are why I can't remember anything. But I mean, seriously, it was just a great, challenging experience. And it's different playing football than baseball or basketball. There's just the physical part of it is what felt important to me, and yet I'm not pushing my son to play it.
It does seem complex and intricate to me in this sort of beautiful, complicated teamwork way. But I have to say, when I saw the headline the other day that the NFL is now admitting that 1 in 3 players are going to have brain injury, I just felt sickened by the idea that my kids are entertaining themselves every weekend by watching people essentially, like, go brain mush. I mean, that's just, there's something just icky about that. It's upsetting.
Last question on this, because we didn't deal with it. There is a fascinating racial component to this Adrian Peterson discussion. You have seen, in the wake of the allegations against Peterson, Black Americans weighing in, saying, at first it was sort of the Charles Barkley response was, well, if Peterson is being charged, every Black parent
in
America is a criminal.
Yeah.
And then you've had a response to that from liberal academics mostly, saying, well, this is a bad cultural element of African-American life. We need to break it. There are reasons why it has instilled itself so deep in African-American life, but, you know, we've got to root it out. It isn't doing anyone any benefit. Do you think that there's a separate conversation that Black America should have about this that is different than the conversation that we're having about it? We don't have a Black commentator on to talk about it, so it's going to be GabFest listeners, prepare your hate emails right now. But
I was actually talking this morning about this with Ta-Nehisi Coates. I'm not going to try to channel him because I don't think that he had exactly his own stance. But I think the idea that the family you grew up in really determines your attitudes about this, and that then you have to think about, like, were you scared of your parents because they were spanking you? And do you want your kids to be scared of you? It seems like you can over push the racial aspect of this, because I think there are plenty of non-Black families in which those elements were there. And that's sort of the crucial question to me.
All right. Let's leave it there. Let us go to cocktail chatter. John Dickerson, you, because of these concussions, you probably can't remember anything. You've probably written your cocktail chatter down in like 58-point type in front of you. So I'm going to let you go first and let you get it out of the way, and then you can go rest.
I'm like a goldfish. You know, the little plastic castle is a surprise every time. First, I want to shout out to my friends who said hello at the Harkin Steak Fry. GabFest listeners, that was great. It's always wonderful when people stop and say they like the show, because I have low self-esteem, and so it buoys me up. But more important, the Harkin Steak Fry, which was attended by about 200 journalists, went in for a lot of ribbing, because there are a lot of people said, why are 200 people going to Iowa to watch Hillary Clinton? Seems to me if you went into Indianola and were there to see what Hillary Clinton was doing, that was really actually a big waste of time. The reason to go to these big, huge, focusing events is not for the Hillary Clinton, who will be covered by 58 different cameras, but for the people who also go there. And, you know, this was true once again with all the conversations I had with the other people who had come to be there for Tom Harkin, who'd represented the state for 40 years, to pay tribute to him, to pay tribute to the role that government had played in their lives. This happens at Republican events as well. People are there to pay tribute to a certain set of ideas that they think the person speaking represents. And it's just a great way to reconnect with human beings. Many human beings are not evident in politics the way we often see it on Twitter and Facebook and cable news shows where everybody's yelling at each other. And so my favorite one, among all the wonderful conversations I had, was with a guy named David Kunstweiler. He's 60 years old. He's a telephone repairman. Over about the 17 minutes we talked on the side of that hill, I can't even go through all the things that we talked about, but including how kids learn about money, TED Talks, ISIS, how a president has to sometimes go on the offense. But my favorite was when he told me about going to see the Dalai Lama, and David said this. He said, I've seen the Dalai Lama. I'll give you a little bit about the Dalai Lama. Now, you have to imagine this in a very thick Midwestern accent. I'll give you a little bit about the Dalai Lama. I thought I would be revived or whatever insight I would get. It's not that way there. You already know what's good in you. That's what I caught from that. You don't have to have the insight. It's already in you. So I just want to say thanks to all the good people of Iowa.
I feel that John, whenever John goes to the Midwest, he ends up refreshed. It's for you, what Dharamsala is for some people.
Your oasis that you dip into.
It's true. I think it's true. The Midwest is very powerful for me.
It's because you're such a basically decent, nice human being. And so when people say hello to you and want to talk to you, it feels sunny to you as opposed to oppressive.
Well, that's different from the, I mean, these are poor people who are trying to enjoy their afternoon who I then go up and interrupt. So they're,
That's true. That's a good
different
point.
Dynamic. No, it's nice when people come up and say hi. That makes it easy, right? Because you don't have to like interrupt them from whatever they're quietly trying to do. This one poor woman was trying to smoke a cigarette and she almost caught herself on fire trying to be polite about not blowing smoke in my face.
Emily, what's your chatter?
My chatter is, with great joy, my favorite cooking writer, Jenny Rosenstock, has a new book out called Dinner, the Playbook. And it is such a revelation. I know, David, you are a better cook than I am and willing to try more complicated things, but I run out of steam during the week and need really easy ideas. And my kids will tell you that they are basically eating beans like 3 or 4 nights of the week. And so here comes Jenny with a 30-day plan, all these like fairly quick, easy but tasty kid-friendly recipes that you can try. I will confess that my babysitter is involved in the cooking of these recipes so far. So that maybe is not quite like the family dinner plan where you are cooking with your kids. But we are all really enjoying the eating. And I just think this book is like a great idea for working families. Even if my babysitter wasn't helping, if I got home in time to do this cooking, I would be really happy to be making some new things. So if you are in a rut of beans or pasta or whatever other really simple food, you should try out this book.
That sounds awesome. My chatter, I went to the Smithsonian Museum Support Center this week, behind the scenes where they keep the magical things they're not displaying, the Ark of the Covenant kind of stuff, doing research on them. It's an amazing place. Mostly I was looking at the marine mammal stuff. During that, I actually got to handle a narwhal tusk, which means I am a wizard, apparently. Handling a narwhal tusk makes you a wizard. But the most amazing part was that we were on this corridor filled with row upon row of animal skulls. And it was very spooky. You're looking at all these big animal skulls. And I just looked down at one at my feet and looked at the acquisition tag. They have the original acquisition tag. And it said 1909 T. Roosevelt. And then I looked at the next one down and it said 1909 T. Roosevelt. And then another one, T. Roosevelt. And these were all elephant skulls. And the curator explained these had all been gathered by Roosevelt right after he left office as the president. He went on this expedition to Africa for the Smithsonian, and he came back with 11,400 samples. Most of them are kind of plants and animals, but there were more than 500 large animals, including 37 different antelope species, 11 elephants, 10 buffalo, 17 lions, 7 cheetahs, 20 rhinos. You can imagine the carnage. But it was so crazy to be in this room, and you're just looking and realizing, oh, this was an elephant that Teddy Roosevelt shot, that the nation has kept this skull for 105 years, and it's just sitting there in a warehouse somewhere in suburban Maryland. It was amazing. It was very it was a Dickersonian moment. Our producer is Mike Volo. Thank you, Mike. Our intern is Max Tawney. Andy Bowers is our executive producer. Our show page is slate.com/gabfest. It has links to what we talked about today. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/gabfest. Our Twitter feed is @SlateGabFest. And our email address is gabfest@slate.com. So all you people who emailed me about how the British Empire was so terrible, or tweeted about how the British Empire was so terrible, I just think you're totally wrong. But bring them on. Keep that wave of hateful correspondence. I think your choice is not... The question is not, did the British Empire do terrible things? Of course they did. Were they relatively better than all the reasonable alternatives? And the answer to that is totally, totally much better than, like, imagine if it would have been the Germans who colonized everywhere, or the Russians, or the Chinese, or the Japanese, or the Belgians, for God's sake. The British were so much better than the reasonable alternatives.
No, good grief. Now you're in like counterfactual land. Who can even debate that with you? Because we don't know what all these other places would have done.
You can look at what they did in the colonies they had. You can look at the Belgian Congo. That's not a good one.
Right, but neither is like India and Pakistan.
Of course, bad things happen. Like, things happen that were different and for some people much worse than they would have been. But taken on aggregate, yes, I will take the British Empire over all of those anytime.
All right, listeners, you'll have to go set David straight or just send more invective.
Also, any judgment like this is inherently counterfactual because history happened. These things happened. So it's not like you can say your liking or not liking of it is not relevant because they did happen. It's sort of like you have to weigh them against what the alternatives would be, and those are inherently counterfactual. You can't make any judgment about history that isn't in some sense counterfactual.
All right.
All right. Anyway, please subscribe to the Gabfest on iTunes. Get arguments like this in maximum rather than in minimum. You can leave a comment and rating while you're there. Search for Slate Political Gabfest in the iTunes store. And for Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We'll talk to you next week.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.